A Thursday chat between you and I on May 9th, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today, where we feature Governor Ned Lamont's remarks on a controversial bill that would set aside state assistance for striking private sector workers. We welcome back Southern Connecticut State University Professor of Biology, Dr. Sarah Crawford. She had the latest news on a possible bird flu pandemic. And Only in Bridgeport blogger Lenny Grimaldi checked in with his weekly Thursday update on all things Bridgeport.
So you remember a few days ago, where we talked about one bill in particular toward the end of the General Assembly session that I said money-wise, it's not that big of a deal, but it's one of those bills that really, if you look at it and all the political twister that's involved around it, if you look at that bill, you start to go, all right, here we go again. And it's a bill that really, really, really outlines bigger issues here beyond what the money is. And we're talking about the bill, and we've got remarks from Governor Ned Lamont in a few minutes, courtesy of CTN earlier today. There was about 3 or 4 minutes of questioning about this bill, whether or not the state should set aside money for workers who are on strike. Now, these aren't workers who were let go by their employer or workers who were laid off. In other words, the use of the state's unemployment fund would not be the seed of the money here. In fact, the Democratic majority in Hartford, led by Martin Looney of New Haven, got into a bit of a headbutting exchange politically and verbally with Steve Harding, who's a regular guest on this program, the Republican Senate leader from Brookfield. And the notion here is they don't even call the fund for what it is. And you'll hear the governor in a second come out and say, if you want to do something like this, don't hide it. Come on out. Have the gouliones. No, the governor didn't say gouliones. The governor didn't say balls. He didn't say guts. You'll hear the governor come out and say what I've been saying. There's two issues here. Number one, do I think any sort of state funding from money from state coffers should go to striking workers? No. Now, if you're laid off, if you lose your job for any reason that would qualify you for traditional unemployment, state unemployment funding, then yeah, who can argue with that? You have employers who pay into the unemployment insurance fund. There's a reason that's there, because usually you collect unemployment if you're forced to become unemployed because of something your boss may have done, or something or some action or some buyout or whatever that causes your unemployment. So there's two things here. There is the actual bill itself and all the political two-stepping about this. And, you know, there's also the theory or the question or the recognition of whether or not a state should get involved in some sort of disagreement between a private sector employer, not the state employees union, not anybody covered by CBAC. But the question remains, should the state stick a toe in the water and get involved in a private labor dispute between some group of employees and an employer or employers? Now, this came to a head late yesterday and last night. The bill was passed. I guess there were some threats here regarding, well, what the Senate Democratic leader Martin Looney would do. He threatened to do something that was almost kind of, and this is my words, not theirs, kind of a nuclear option thing, to force a vote rather than allowing the Republicans to run out the clock here. So in the end, this ended up passing. Now, the Senate voted 23-12 with all Republicans opposed, one conservative Democrat, Senator Joan Hartley of Waterbury, not voting. She exited the chamber prior to the vote and returned at its conclusion. So I don't know, Senator Hartley, I've never spoken to her. So you folks in Waterbury, you may want to ask her what was going on. Why did she leave the Senate chamber right before the vote began and then came back when it was done? I don't know. Was nature calling? Did she forget something somewhere? So again, 35 of the 36 Senate members voting last night, all the Republicans voted no. All the Democrats present voted yes. Joan Hartley of Waterbury not voting. She exited the chamber prior to the vote, says here in the Connecticut Mirror, and returned at its conclusion. The bill would have given strikers unemployment benefits after two consecutive weeks, I believe, on the picket line. Now, of course, you know, progressive Democrats in Hartford say, well, this kind of helps strikers. It evens out the field. Well, that's fine if you have a strike fund. I know some unions do, some unions don't. But really, and again, I don't hate you. I'm all for collective bargaining. I belonged to a union at one time. I didn't have a choice, but I had to. My son's in a very powerful union in New York. But here's the question. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Do you want state money? Oh, and by the way, there's some funny business about what this bill is called versus what the actual purpose is. And everybody kind of knows what the purpose is, but this bill's got a little bit of a funky kind of name. You know, this happened late on Friday night last and then dragged into this week. But it's a basic question here, which I don't think is a hard question. Now, I tend to think, no, should any state money be used to benefit strikers? Again, we're talking about people who, if you use the term strike in the traditional sense, now, sometimes you don't know what's mandated in these bills. I'm sure people are still looking at them. But it's a basic question here, and I'll put it up on our Facebook page pretty soon at facebook.com/WICC600. Should Governor Ned Lamont sign or veto a bill that would, in some cases, pay state money to striking workers, private sector striking workers? I say that's a big fat no. Why? Explain to me why. Well, you know, we have to even the playing field. No. It's no. It's not the place of a state government to even the playing field in a private labor dispute unless, okay, let me qualify that now. That's why the National Labor Relations Board exists. There are other things going on here. So there are striking workers do have now some unions are more powerful than others. Other shops don't have unions, be that as it may, whether there was ever a union vote canceled or not held or it was voted down. But again, why should explain to me in any cogent term? And please not with the warm fuzzies here. Well, it's the right thing to do. Well, wait a minute. You think it's the right thing to do. Is it the right thing to do in the eyes of a private business who, for whatever reason, see its workers go out on strike and then the state, and don't tell me the state isn't taking sides, because they are. Now, you may think it's okay to take sides. I don't think it is. And apparently neither does Governor Ned Lamont. Now, notice in this, he's trying not to say he'll veto this bill that would give state money to private sector striking workers. Only two other states have this. So this is not like this is the new wave across the country. So this is just after his opening remarks earlier today. I believe it's Mark Pazniokas who jumps in here first on the Connecticut Mirror. And he basically asked the governor, hey, on this bill that would give state funding to striking workers in the private sector. You like, Ned, or not?
Are you going to sign or veto the bill that would provide state assistance to striking workers?
I don't support it. I'll tell you why. I just think it was too cute by half. If you want to have public dollars to support striking workers, have a vote, up or down. I want public dollars to go support striking workers. That was not the bill that I think came out of there, and so let's just say I'm very skeptical.
Well, wait a minute. You're skeptical. Are you going to veto it?
Not going to support it. let me see what we end up with. Let me take a look at it. It's so damn vague. I don't really know what's in it, but I am not supportive.
I know what you ended up with. I mean, there's five lines of description. You have had discussions with the leaders, and I believe Scanlon, about how it would work. So again,
I don't think anybody knows how it's going to work.
Well,
but that said, everything I know about it, I'm not going to support it. If you want to do this, have a real vote next year, so people know what they're voting on, not at 11:45.
Do you support the concept? Because New York and New Jersey have something similar on the books.
I'm not sure I do.
Why is that?
What? Look, I'm one of the six pro-union guys in Greenwich, Connecticut. I think because union movement was not strong over the last 30 years, we've hollowed out our middle class, especially when it comes to the service sector. I support the right to organize. I support defined benefit plans. I support expanded health care. And I want to make sure that we have a strong labor that's able to negotiate at the table. Does that mean I want the taxpayers, subsidizing striking workers? I don't think I do.
All right. My God, some clarity from Hartford. Oh, now, you may not like that. What do you think of what you just heard there from Governor Ned Lamont earlier today, who said, now, he didn't say, I am going to veto the bill. He never once, in that roughly 2 minutes, minute and 50-something and change there that I hollowed out, if you noticed that, and, of course, you had these... the obligatory, oh, my God, but New York and Massachusetts are doing it. And Ned goes, yeah, I don't think it's a good idea. The word he kept, well, one of the words he used there was skeptical. And he says nobody, and boy, I got to tell you, if this doesn't illustrate some of the shenanigans that go on in Hartford, nobody really knows what's in the bill. Explain to me, Lucy, how governors, Democrat or Republican, House leaders, Senate leaders, members say, well, we have to read the bill. We're not wait a minute. You notice how on these kind of funky bills that people don't like a lot of them, well, I have to read the bill. I'm not sure what. Wait a minute. You have staff members. Don't tell me you don't all talk. You know what, folks? I have to read the bill. Oh, I've got to consult what the bill is in there. That's one of two things. Either you're flat out lying that you know what's in the bill there and you have to cushion this, or you're not paying attention. One of the two. Welcoming back now a guest I had on the program numerous times during the COVID-19 pandemic. Thankfully, that is past us, but starting to see things even in the mainstream media now regarding the avian or bird flu, and some of the stuff seems a tad ominous. Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University, joins us. Dr. Crawford, Paul here again. Good to have you back. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to talk to you again. How are you doing?
I'm good, Dr. Crawford. Great to have you back. But hey, what is this
Thank
now?
You.
What is this I'm seeing about the avian flu, the bird flu, the transmission here? Before we get to any area of concern for my audience, Dr. Crawford, define, they may say, see bird flu, avian flu, define that for us.
Okay, well, this is a version of the flu virus. It's called H5N1. It primarily affects birds, which is why we call it the bird flu. Actually, it may have been around since the 1600s. They used to call it the fowl plague. And for many, many years, it seemed to stay restricted to wild birds. And then over the last century, it has begun to infect poultry, spread worldwide. It originated in Asia, and now most recently affecting livestock, cows. The dairy industry really hit hard by this. So it's of concern because this is changing and morphing into a virus which has a potential threat to impact us in many ways.
Yeah, I started in just the news cycle, Dr. Crawford, to see these stories about 3 weeks ago. And you're right, I saw some of the red flags raised because of, what they found it in milk samples that they traced to some dairy cows, I think, in the Pacific Northwest. Is that right?
Well, yes, in the Pacific Northwest and also in quite a few states, about 36 herds that have been identified to be infected by this virus. And yes, it the genetic material has been detected in milk and in certain other milk products, which doesn't mean you have the live virus, but it means that the material was from a source that was infected. And however, pasteurization completely kills off the virus. So there's no alarm in terms of spreading it through the consumption of daily dairy products.
So how then did that end up in the cows? Basically just what, contact with birds or other forms of men?
You know, you just hit on one of the most important questions, as usual, which is for a very long time, it was restricted to wild birds and poultry. It managed to make its way to poultry. How it made its way to cows is unknown, but this is a very flexible virus. It can change its genetic material. We've heard about that kind of virus before.
Mm-hmm.
And this virus, not only did it make a jump in the early 2000s, apparently, to cows after widespread infection among poultry, but also to other mammals. So now it's spreading through many different types of foxes, raccoons, you know, mammals, dogs, cats can catch it. So it's circling and spreading, and the alarm bell is sounding because the closer you get, you know, you're getting farther away from birds and into mammals, you're getting closer to humans.
Yeah.
And we do know that humans can be infected. Usually, we have been able to trace the few cases that have occurred to direct contact with an infected animal. But because these viruses can morph, you're always concerned that further issues may develop in terms of contagion to humans. So that's why the CDC and the WHO and the FDA are all on alert and really trying to monitor this as closely as possible.
How serious, Dr. Crawford, is this? Is this avian flu, this strain of the virus, potentially to a human? If I were to get this sitting here now, worse than the regular flu or a seasonal flu or what?
There's been, you know, quite honestly, there's been so little human transmission that it's impossible for us to make a statement about that. We don't know. It's happened so rarely, which is fortunate. But we do know that in a few children, one of the first cases ever documented was about almost 40 years ago, and in an Asian boy at 3 years old got sick and died. Several other young children died. But for the most part, it hasn't circulated as far as we know in humans. So we don't really know what it would be like. We do know that it was responsible for a large wild bird die-off in Asia in the early 2000s. We know that it is very interestingly, it doesn't necessarily infect the lungs. It goes throughout the body and can infect the gut and other organ systems of the body. So this is a very unusual virus, and it's of concern. And the other issue is it's very hard to monitor. They're trying to monitor wastewater. It's very hard to monitor among the farming industry, dairy industry, because dairy farmers are very much alarmed at this point because they don't want to see their industry decimated. So they're resisting efforts for federal, you know, agents to come in and test their cows and all of that. So you've got a lot of competing issues here. And it's something that is of concern because of the fact that it is moving among mammals. And we know that humans can get infected, and we don't know enough about it to know what the consequence would be.
Sure. A couple things here before we wrap up with Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology, Sacred Heart, Southern Connecticut State University. Did I read where we're kind of now, Dr. Crawford, out of the regular flu season here, give or take a little bit in spots? And if that's so, how did we do?
Well, it was sort of a typical flu season. We had sort of a tail end that kind of perked up a little bit more than people had hoped. But it was a typical season, nothing unusual. And we are at the tail end. as the summer sun comes through and we have more light available, it seems to be a great protector against these viruses. So we should be safe till the dark days of next November.
And finally, I want to ask you about COVID. You know, you and I were talking at the beginning about 4 years ago. We got through that, but it's still out there. I have a couple of friends who have it now mildly, and they'll be back what they're doing in a few days. But what do we see there? Obviously, it's in the system now. It's in the ecosystem. So, could we get another variant on COVID? Where do we stand now?
Well, it probably will continue to, alter itself in various permutations moving forward. But fortunately, because of natural selection, the virus wants to infect as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's being selected for, and not necessarily kill the host, which is not a good thing for the virus. Because if the host dies, then the virus has no place to go. So the virus is morphing into more of a mild type a virus that doesn't seem to be having such serious effects in most people. Mm-hmm. And it's something to be aware of. But not certainly it's not the same virus we were talking about way back in 2020, 21.
Absolutely. Great. Thanks, Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, good to chat with you. We'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Wonderful. Take care, Paul.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right. So there you have it. Hey, a lot of you, you looked forward at one time to Matt Drudge when he was doing radio, to the great Walter Winchell when he had the scoop. None of those guys are like Lenny Grimaldi and only in Bridgeport.com. Lenny, how are you?
I'm the best pooper scooper in the city.
How are you, man?
Know that?
Yeah.
But
Lenny, I'm going to have you move a little bit. You're cutting out a little bit, and let's start with Marilyn Moore saying she's had enough. She's 75, and in that district, Lenny, she represents. I said this on the show yesterday. That might be one of the most challenging districts to get a candidate from. You have part of Bridgeport, you've got Trumbull and part of Monroe, so you've got geographically it's pretty big, and you have a real variance there in the type of homeowner or constituent you have to represent.
Yeah, arguably it's the most diverse state Senate district in Connecticut. Talking about Connecticut's 22nd state Senate district, which Marilyn Moore has held for, over 10 years or about 10 years now. But, the city that really disappoints for its politics strikes again. So yesterday was the final day of the legislative session, and Marilyn Moore chose that final day to announce she's not running for reelection. It's now a really chaotic situation. Why? Because Tuesday is the endorsement for the seat.
Jeez.
Tuesday.
Right? Tuesday, as in this coming Tuesday.
Why wait to the last minute?
Yeah, wow.
Right? Answer the phone. Why wait? So now you've got a large swirl of politicians looking at that seat, potentially a big field, right? So now here's how this stuff works.
Okay.
Tuesday at City Hall, there is going to be what they call the convention for the endorsement.
Yep.
You're going to have a whole bunch of candidates there. And between now and then, they're going to be banging phones.
Yeah.
Right? There's about 56 delegates to the convention.
Okay.
And this district is about a third of Bridgeport, all of Trumbull, and a piece of Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need to qualify for the ballot is 15% support among the delegates.
That's not much. Yeah.
Right. So basically, you need basically 9 votes. So you're going to have people like former Mayor Bill Finch.
Wow.
Going to look at it because Bill Finch had the seat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Finch could probably make the most compelling argument because he can say, with Marilyn gone, there's a leadership vacuum. And I was there for 7 years. Mm-hmm. I know leadership. I know how it works. Right? But then you're going to have, people like some Trumbull people there. You're going to have City Councilman Tyler Mack, who just recently moved out of the adjoining 23rd District into the 22nd. He's now in Black Rock. So this Bridgeport piece is really the north end, west side, Black Rock piece of the west. So Tyler Mack is going to get in it. You're going to have a Trumbull candidate as well, but one of the leading candidates is Sujata Wilcox.
Okay.
She's a professor at the University of Bridgeport. At Quinnipiac.
Okay.
And so you could have several others that are going to be in it too.
Interesting. So, wow. Before two, I didn't realize that time frame. So
Tuesday. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
wow.
Also, one other piece is, so if someone's going to be endorsed, probably, all right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Possibly be some kind of open convention. I don't know. But if you don't get the 15% support at the convention, you can petition your way onto the ballot by securing, it's mm-hmm. a very labor-intensive process, by securing 5% signatures from registered Democrats in the
yeah.
district.
Marilyn Moore's legacy, Lenny, if you had to, on short notice here, sum it up, what would you say?
I would say on social issues, very good, on housing issues, bringing the housing issue to light in Connecticut. And it's just not Connecticut. It's a pretty tough situation throughout the country. And, you know, she started, you know, there's this commission to address affordable housing needs, you know, renters' rights. She was good on that. She wasn't someone who initiated a lot of her own ideas, but she was good with taking ideas and carrying the ball down the field.
Heron Gaston, I understand there's something up with him. What's up with him?
So Heron Gaston is the other state senator representing Bridgeport.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the city payroll for a number of years. Last August, the mayor kicked out a news release stating that Senator Heron Gaston was going to leave city service to accept position of chief of staff at the University of Bridgeport. And it was framed in such a way traditionally he'd be there for a little while, but really the message was he's going to be off the payroll in the near future
mm-hmm.
and going to be his chief of staff, which is, you know, pretty heady position over there. Problem was, he never left the payroll.
Oops.
Oops. Yeah. He remained on the payroll.
Yeah.
The mayor wanted him around, you know, on a part-time basis. But, you know, I just found out just a few days ago, I'm the biggest dummy in the world. He's been on the payroll all along, right?
Hmm.
And so now here's where you get the dynamic in play.
Okay.
Guess who is the co-chair of the Budget and Appropriations Committee for the city council? None other than city councilman Ernie Newton.
Ah.
Right?
Yeah.
Who is Heron Gaston's opponent for an August primary. So it's the nuts and bolts of the budget is put together by the Budget and Appropriations Committee with the two leading co-chairs. They have the power of 10, right? And as we're speaking, they're meeting to talk about the budget. They're probably going to vote on the budget tonight. It goes to the full council on Monday. I'm guessing they're not going to fund this position.
Hmm.
That's a guess. So
would there be any move, would there be for him to return some of that money or not?
Well, so he's been I talked to him about that.
Yeah.
So it's a position that was budget. So he basically was making like $140,000 in his full-time position.
Yeah.
This budgeted role was for $72,000, right? And he claims he's been paid about $45,000. You know, he puts in paperwork every single week based on his hours. So, you know, he's claiming he's been there maybe 15 or 20 hours a week.
Right.
Some people, he hasn't even been out there that much. You know, Newton will tell you he doesn't show up for the job, right? He's never here, you know? So that's where it gets sticky with the political dynamic with his opponent as co-chair of the budget committee. And, you know, I had several conversations with Heron Gaston today. He said he was going to make a decision within the next day or two whether he was going to stay on the job or resign.
Interesting. Wow. Never a dull moment at Bridgeport. Never a dull moment with Lenny Grimaldi and his old boss, Mr. Trump. Lenny, the testimony, the cross-examination of Ms. Clifford Nee Daniels continuing here. I said earlier in the show, I know whether you heard me, I said, I can't wait, Lenny, to hear the interviews of people or their book deals or their magazine deals or their sit-downs on Dateline or Fox or MSNBC or whatever on this, because some of this testimony from Ms. Daniels herself, I mean, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, Lenny. I mean, this stuff is, you can't script this. You can't.
Isn't it beautiful? It's chaotic. I mean, he loves chaos, but not this kind.
Oh.
Yeah, we've been talking about it for a while. A lot of salacious information is coming out of this thing. And, you know, it's like, you know, people asking, what's the jury thinking about this? I mean, the jury doesn't even have to like the witnesses.
Yeah.
And the government's, the critical role of the government is corroborating what the witnesses say. They can dislike the witness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, Michael Cohen's going to come up, and Cohen is not a very likable person. Let's face it, right?
No.
So, and so he's going to face a really difficult cross examination. But by the time they get to Cohen, the government feels we're laying this thing out so that there's a lot of credibility with him coming on the stand because we're corroborating a lot of things
mm-hmm.
in advance and also afterwards. Right. So, and you know, I do give Stormy Daniels some credit because she's pretty good on the rejoinders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coming back at times, you know, just reading the articles and stuff. She was sticking to, you know, the so-called script.
Yeah.
You know, when you take the stand, you work with the prosecutors.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
What you're going to be saying, and she probably strayed a little bit too much on stuff, with, you know, some extracurricular verbiage.
but still interesting, as I heard somebody say the other day, Lenny, on one of the myriad of analyses of this whole thing, I guess the Trump people in the end are going to say, look, this is a paperwork thing that should have been a misdemeanor, but the statute of limitations is over and it's a stretch trying to make this into election interference. So it's, I don't know, man, if you get a hung jury here, if everybody decides, I can't wait for a verdict on this. I mean, it's wild.
All he needs is one.
Yeah, we talked about that. Lenny Grimaldi, only in Bridgeport.com. Lenny, thanks, and we'll chat with you next week. Thank you, sir.
See you next week.
All right, buddy. Thanks. Bye-bye.